You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 23rd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor James Galbraith, author of the new Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. Also, I am back in New York City. And we have no Matt for today and tomorrow, so hopefully you're hearing what I'm saying. Also on the program today, huge, huge breaking story about Walmart. Nice New York Times piece on Alec. Bit of a shareholders revolt going on. And of course, we are just days away, if we're not already there, from student debt hitting $1 trillion in this country. We could already be there, but peg the day for Wednesday and Occupy gearing up for some activity on that day. Also, as I was on the Up with Chris this weekend, and it got some mention there, but checking in on the Financial Fraud Task Force, they can't seem to get their stuff together, or they haven't gotten their stuff together, or they have no plan to get their stuff together. But we will dip into that in just a moment. I want to just touch on this Walmart story briefly before we go and pick up Professor Galbraith. According to the New York Times, this is a massive story. But the gist of it is, back in September of 2005, a senior Walmart lawyer got an email from a former executive at the company's largest subsidiary, Walmart de Mexico, In the email and in follow-up conversations, it turns out that the former executive described a huge system, a campaign of bribery to win market dominance in Mexico. Es muy malo. Because U.S. companies are not supposed to bribe foreign officials, certainly not have a campaign of doing so. It turns out Walmart started an investigation, and when they found that these allegations were correct, they decided to stop the investigation. Now, I'm no lawyer, but the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act says that you as an American company are, and individuals who run that company are liable in the event that you are aware, so there is that bar, you need to be aware of a systemic problem of bribery with one of your subsidiaries in bribing a foreign officials. This is why you're going to see News Corp is in some hot water in Britain.
but this could be really devastating for Walmart, and certainly their shares have dropped. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor James Galbraith, about his latest book, Inequality and Instability. We'll be right back after this. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor James K. Galbraith. He is the author of Inequality and Instability, a professor at LBJ School of Public Affairs, University of Texas. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you.
So let's start off with the inequality of instability. Why that title as opposed to the implications, I guess, of inequality?
Because instability is the major implication of inequality, in my view. I think that really what one is when one measures economic inequality in the U.S. and around the world, what you're picking up is the degree to which the overall economic performance is going to be unstable, and in the case of really high inequality, radically unstable.
Now, there's been determinations of inequality in the past, but you took a more rigorous and perhaps a different tact on measuring inequality.
Yes, there's been a lot of work compiling basically household surveys around the world over 50 years. But the problem is that's very expensive to do, and there are lots and lots of gaps in the data. So underlying the book was a research effort to fill in the gaps using whatever sources of information happened to be available. And it turns out there's quite a lot of that. And so it was really a matter of setting groups of students to work, compiling the information and making calculations. And then when we had that, we had the basis for a very systematic assessment.
What's really interesting, I think, from my perspective, is your findings of how, in some respects, inequality is so isolated geographically, at least in this country. Can you speak to that?
Well, in the U.S., when you measure inequality from tax records and you look at where the incomes were registered, you find that a very large share of the rise in inequality happened in a very small number of places. New York, Manhattan is a very important place for high incomes in the United States because that is the headquarters of Wall Street. In the late 1990s, a very substantial part of the rise in inequality occurs in just a handful of places, the most prominent ones being Silicon Valley, basically three counties in Northern California, and King County, Washington, Seattle, or more precisely, I guess, Bellevue, the headquarters of Microsoft. So we're, looking at the effect of very particular phenomena that are, geographically very restricted. If you take out 15 counties from the U.S. data in the late 1990s, the rise in inequality measured between counties goes away entirely. That isn't to say there wouldn't have been any rise in inequality without that, but it would have been much smaller than it was.
So what is the history of inequality in this country? This is a phenomenon that really, according to your book, took place mostly during the course of a 20-year period.
I would say in the U.S. you have to go back maybe 30 years. It's to the 1970s, but in the world at large, the period from 1980 to 2000 was decisive. Almost every country at some point in that period had a massive rise in inequality. It's really quite remarkable and quite consistent around the world. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that that shows that there were common global forces at work. This was not a matter of individual countries making independent decisions, but things that affected them all.
And that common force was essentially finance.
Largely finance, yes. The effect of the debt crisis, the effect of high interest rates in the early 1980s, the pressures that debt payment placed on the economic performance. This was a very messy period in Latin America, Central Europe, and ultimately in Asia.
And so this increase in inequality, was it a function of the concentration of wealth on the high end, or was it a function of sort of the bottom falling further?
Both. People with low incomes, so they don't have to fall very far to hurt a lot, and that happened around the world. And a lot of the cost of adjustment in the U.S. in the 1980s was transferred outside the U.S. by high interest rates and collapsing commodity prices. So low-income people were hurt around the world. High-income people, particularly in parts of the U.S., did very well, as we all know. So you have both phenomena going on.
And in the context of this country, this notion of finance, you can track, or you've tracked the rising inequality with the stock market. How does that work?
Well, straightforwardly, capital asset ownership, stock ownership is very concentrated. And so people who are experiencing capital gains are going to be reporting that on their tax returns, capital gains, stock options realizations, and also incomes that are paid as salaries by companies that are raising funds in the markets. And so when you have a stock bubble, so you had this enormous one in the technology sector that peaked in 2000, that shows up as the taxable incomes of a very small number of very wealthy people, and that's a major source of the rise in inequality in the U.S. in income inequality in that period.
And we say, I mean, is it a function of, in terms of the inequality it being a source, is essentially is because this is what we talk about when we talk about finance. In some ways, creating these disparity. I mean, we could have had. I mean, part of that, I imagine, is also that money is treated differently by our tax code. But the sheer amounts that are generated through that process is the implication is that when people make their money that way, they does not have the same social or the same income implications for the rest of the country. In other words, if I was to make money, a tremendous amount of money with a factory, the implications are that I'm also hiring a lot of people.
Well, that's right. And in this period, you're looking at incomes that were being made that had relatively little direct employment creation in those sectors. But I should be careful about that, because the late 1990s saw a lot of employment growth generally in the economy. It was a prosperous period. The unemployment rate overall fell to under 4% for 3 years. So one can't say that this rise in inequality was a period of misery for the country as a whole. Quite the contrary. It was the last period, great period of general prosperity. And the problem was not there. The problem was that it was financially and unsustainable, and it came to a crashing end in 2000. And then we had another period where there's a different financially driven, not really a boom, but growth period in subprime mortgages that led directly to the debacle. So once again, one has the rise in inequality and a subsequent collapse. And that's again why I emphasize in the book that the issue here facing most people is not that they feel badly when inequality in incomes is rising. On the contrary, most working people have more opportunities when that's the case. But they're in an intrinsically unstable environment, and you're going to end up with a crash.
Well, now, so was the inequality that was driven in, I mean, in the aughts, I guess, or to the extent that we made it through there without a crisis. Much of this was being driven by debt. Is that the same case in the 90s?
Yeah, different debtors. In the 90s, you're talking about venture capital basically financing information technology companies. That's the major driver of the boom in the 90s. And up until the crash in 2007, 2008, it's housing prices, which are being driven by debt taken on by households, in many cases households who were never in position where they could have repaid those loans, and the loans were crafted so that they could not be repaid. So you have what is in the late 2000s a really sordid story of the abuse of financial power. But while it's going on, it is putting money into the economy and creating more employment, more construction than would otherwise have been there.
And so, I mean, if I'm bringing this out, I mean, during the 90s, there was a inequality is rising, but growth is more widely shared. And so the implications are not felt. That was unsustainable because it was a function of sort of just inflating these companies. And it was then sort of, I guess, somewhat mitigated by the even more unsustainable credit economy.
Well, I think both were unsustainable. I think you can make a stronger case for the information technology boom because you are, after all, funding companies that are, in most cases, attempting to do something. The provision of cash-out refinancing to people who cannot and could never afford to repay the loans was something that should have been stopped by bank regulators. I mean, it was something which was intrinsically fraudulent. The loans were being made to people whose incomes were not being recorded, whose credit ratings were bad, whose houses were overappraised. This was known. This could only happen because the people making the loans were selling them off and to the unwary investors, in many cases overseas. So they were committing a fraud, basically, as they went through this process. You could make a case that in the information technology sector, well, there's enthusiasm and ebullience, the ratio of reasonably good prospects to strictly far-fetched ones is higher. It's not perfect, but it's right. Higher. And so, you make a case for the first period over the second.
And so then inequality essentially plateaued theoretically in the first decade of this century. Do we know? I mean, I assume that you didn't have an opportunity to necessarily look at data post-crisis. In other words,
we have since the book went to press. We've gotten some new data, and it follows the same basic story. The stock market comes. The inequality measured, again, this is doing it across counties where you have very readily accessible, up to date data. Inequality falls in the Great Crisis, and then rises again with the stock market recovery.
And that's indicative of essentially that the inequality is pushing up maybe the top more than it is pushing sort of people into the bottom, or is it?
That's basically right. In tax records, you're looking at something which is being driven substantially by the incomes at the very top. I mean, it's not to say bad things aren't happening to people further down, but a measure of inequality is going to be very sensitive to what's happening at the high end.
What were the forces that created this financialization of our economy, or I should say a larger portion of our economy becoming finance?
Well, this is a long process through the history of post-war America. In the first 25 or 30 years, there were strong regulatory forces that have been put in place following the 1929 crash, the Great Depression. And finance was present, but it was not the dominant force. It began to reassert itself in the 1970s, and in the 1980s there were waves and waves of deregulation, which basically meant that the banking sector became the prime mover in investment. And the these two issues, inequality and stability, and instability, became important once again. There had been practically 30 years without a banking crisis in the U.S. following the Second World War. Once you started to say, well, you know, things are different, those old laws are obsolete, they reflect another era, we should take them away, you start inviting back the same kinds of conduct that got you into trouble 80 years ago.
And so where are we, relatively speaking, to those post-war years in terms of finance as a part of our economy?
We're not just in a different universe. In the post-war period, we had banks were kept quite small. They, generally speaking, did not have interstate operations. They did not have, in many cases, did not have branches. So there were many thousands of banks, and they were their operations were relatively restricted, independent of each other. And so you had the sector, which is also regulated quite strictly, was not the dominant player. It didn't have a treasury department that was almost automatically staffed from the leading firms on Wall Street. And it always had a representation there, but the dominance that has occurred since the 80s was not present. So what we have now is an economy where a handful of gargantuan banks have an enormous economic and political presence. And that is reflected in our politics, the way governments and both parties are put together.
And how did what took place in this country in the 80s, as we start to roll back constraints on financial institutions, was this directly affect the inequality that grew up around the world?
Oh yes, I think it did. I think that actually, beginning in the 1970s, global banking became a key player in economic development and in the economic growth prospects of developing countries. If you had access to credit, you could continue to grow. If you didn't, you couldn't. Then, what happened was that some countries, particularly in Latin America, ran up an enormous amount of debt. And in the early 1980s, they had a crisis because the interest rates changed on them and they couldn't begin to pay it back. You had vast increase in their liabilities, and their commodity prices collapsed. So the income that they were planning to use to pay the debts went away. And that led to several decades of real hardship all the way around the world. Yes, that is a part and parcel of the story of financialization.
And when you talk about instability, are we talking political or instability to the financial or to the economic system? Or are those?
That's an interesting question. I had in mind mainly economic instability, just the tendency to be on a roller coaster of booms and busts. And now, after the Great Crisis, we're in a situation where it's very unlikely that we're going to see another credit boom anytime soon, because so much of the collateral that underpinned the last expansion was wiped out. Housing prices, housing values in particular. Is this also associated with political instability? Well, it may very well be. Individual political systems tend to continue for a while, and when they crack all at once. So we'll see how well what we have holds up. But I think there are serious questions in Europe right now about the stability of the political system that's been created, particularly in the Eurozone.
I ask because, in addition to there being, some books that have come out recently, Why Nations Fail comes to mind, about the sort of the implications of when the elite fail, or whether the institutions have become less inclusive, et cetera. But one of the problems it seems to me that we have in this country in terms of is defining our economy based upon metrics that don't necessarily help the broad base of people. In other words, on the stock market, if it seems at least popularly that if the stock market is up, there is there's a far more optimism than frankly should be if you want to consider the vast majority of people in this country. And so I wonder if the, you know, this is a time where we have rising income again or wealth for the at least the richest in the country and, again, driving the markets up. But it's not shared by the vast majority of people in this country.
I think we'll have to see just what the, you know, the most recent rise in the stock market actually delivers. It varies from time to time, depending upon what sector is growing and whether the investment is occurring in the U.S. or elsewhere. I think what we're seeing in, to a substantial extent, with this rise in the stock market has been, first of all, partly the rising cost of resources, which is, you know, maybe good for extractive companies, but not great for people in consuming countries. And secondly, the effect of corporations buying back their own stock with all of the cheap money that they've been given in the last few years. And that, again, is not – there's no necessary reason to believe that that's going to lead to more employment. So it's not surprising that you've got this kind of disengagement of the stock market now from actual job creation. And so maybe the attitude toward the stock market will change as time goes on. People realize that this is not the 1990s and we're not seeing something that's going to have broad-based effects on working families and their job prospects.
And that it's not necessarily sustainable without that, I guess.
That's, of course, another question. To the extent this is being driven by another round, basically, of very cheap money being provided to the economy by the central bank and being used basically for what is essentially a trading purpose. You get the cash and you buy back your own equity, boost the price that way, pay yourself because you've got a, if you're the executive, because you've got a stock options package, then you're looking at something which is really parasitic on the Federal Reserve's recovery policy and not contributing anything substantial to economic output.
I know we don't have too much time, but I'm interested in also talking about how you found in your research the relationship between inequality and how it affects electoral outcomes, that rich people tend to vote for Republican, but rich states tend to vote Democrat.
This is a paradox which was identified in the political science literature by a very good statistician named Andrew Gilman, and we looked at that to some extent. It's very interesting because you can measure inequality at the state level in the United States, and states are important because of the Electoral College in presidential elections. What we found, and we think this sort of accounts for Andrew Gilman's finding, is that in states where wealthier and poorer areas are geographically separated inside the state, and that's particularly true in large states, you tend to have a much stronger tendency for wealthy people to be voting Democratic. So in New York, California, you got a lot of wealthy Democrats. Connecticut, a lot of wealthy Democrats. Not so much in Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, or Texas, for that matter. And that's an interesting difference.
And so what can be done? I mean, I know that we have examples in Latin America that have essentially reversed the trend of income inequality, and perhaps those are the only examples internationally, more or less. But what needs to be done from a policy standpoint in this country?
A first big thing would be to come to grips with the scale of the financial sector. It should be public policy to downsize it, to bring it down into some useful relation to what it actually does for the economy. We've got these behemoth institutions. They are a big fixed charge on all kinds of private business in this country. And we need to have those resources out there committed to actually doing useful things that need to get done. That's really the first major task, and that's partly, as I said, downsizing the financial sector, partly setting up parallel institutions that can really address themselves to the tasks that need doing.
And politically, that's much more difficult because we don't really have a party at this point that is not beholden to those interests.
Well, I think the Democratic Party needs to face its internal division. And the compromise that's been going on for 25 or 30 years has been to hand economic policy to the financial sector and then to have some concessions for the rest of the population on social questions. And I think what we're the experience of the Great Crisis, this is not a workable strategy. And the members of the Democratic Party need to reassert their interest having a say, even a controlling say, in policies affecting the financial sector.
What do you think has changed? I mean, is it simply just what has changed in our culture or in our politics that has provided for the sort of finance to be unshackled? I mean, and voices like yours to not have the authority within the context of our political system that I think just rationality would dictate.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But, I think the period when there was effective control over financial power, which begins in 1933 with Roosevelt's New Deal and begins to unravel in the 1970s and was unraveling very rapidly when I worked on Capitol Hill in the early 1980s, was a short period, 60 years. And while for those of us of my generation, this was the formative period and we thought we were seeing the construction of a new system that was going to endure, turned out wasn't so. Turned out that power having been controlled can reconcentrate and reassert itself, and that's what we've seen. So we have to come to grips with that once again. And I think the historical period, this period from the 30s to the 80s, when we had a more stable, more balanced system, a system with where power was more dispersed, more widely shared, was a good model. But we got to recognize that it's something that if we want it back, we want something like it, we are going to have a politics that aims for that.
I mean,
and we don't right now.
I mean, was there a specific change? I mean, or was it simply just we were swimming against the tide for those 30 years, and that was sort of the anomaly on some level, and this is something we just has to keep swinging back? Or
well, there were specific changes in the 1970s in particular that made the old model very difficult to sustain and opened the door for a return to concentrate financial power. And those changes had something to do with the way public policy, monetary policy was conducted, something to do with a continuing lobbying for relief from the strictures of the New Deal in the post-war period. And those things were there, and they eventually prevailed. I was working on the banking committee in the House of Representatives in the early 1980s when this started to happen. You could see it happen before your eyes. And while there were people who objected and people who thought it was a bad idea, this was a very powerful political force at the time.
And so it's ultimately sort of the slow corruption in some respects or on the political front that opens the door for this type of economic situation that is ultimately self-defeating too, because as you say, I guess the title of the book is that we can't fundamentally have economic stability with this type of inequality.
I think that's entirely right, yes.
Professor James Galbraith, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Appreciate your coming on. All right, folks, it is because of the nature of we're a little short-staffed here today, so we're going to break a little bit early and head into the better half of the program. You can reach this program. You can be a part of it by calling 646-257-3920 or Skyping me at Majority Live. But better yet, you could stay with us by becoming a member of the Majority Report. Very easy to do. Simply go to majority.fm, click become a member, and then make my day. We could have it will help us technically as we try and grow. It will help us maintain what we have now, and it will get the message out. Coming up in the better half of the program, we're going to talk about this big Walmart story, a great piece in the New York Times on ALEC. Just how, you know, I know we've spoken about it in the past, but this American Legislative Executive Council, which has been suffering some pushback over the past couple of weeks, still just an unbelievably effed up source of legislation in this country that you are financing. Now, I'm not just speaking to those members of our audience who are huge corporate moguls. And I'm not just speaking to those members of our audience who are Republican legislators from around this country who go and spend $50 for a three-day conference. No, I'm talking about you, assuming you are not one of those guys like Wesley Snipes or the Schiff ilk, who refuse to pay your taxes. I'm talking about you who pay your taxes. You are subsidizing ALEC, which, of course, is responsible from all sorts of laws from that strip your capacity to vote, that allow for people to stand their ground with their guns, but also begin to do things like roll back laws protecting you from financial fraud, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get into that more in the better half of the program. Also, a student debt going to hit $1 trillion in just a matter of days. The Obama administration is trying to promote legislation which will maintain a freeze on the increase of interest for some government student loans, which is scheduled to jump from 3.4% to 6.8%, if I remember correctly, in the next couple of months. That's going to be a hard hit. And interesting report from the Bren Center on attack on voting rights. BP anniversary, or I should say the disaster in the Gulf's anniversary last Friday. I've got an interview that I did with one of the members of the plaintiff steering committee, which forged a pretty good deal on behalf of those people involved, particularly economically and health-wise, involved in this disaster down there. We'll run that interview over the next couple of days, but we'll touch on this BP disaster because, well, most of the people I know now who are from that area will tell me they will not eat seafood anymore. And for good reason. It's very hard to imagine there's nothing wrong with shrimp that don't have eye sockets. That should not be the first flag. That's not the red flag, folks. That's the entire kit and caboodle at that point. Also, an update on how the Financial Fraud Committee is doing their job. Here's a hint. Not very intensely is the best I can put. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the better half of the program. You can call me at 646-257-3920. You can Skype me at Majority Live. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a minute.